The sun and the light, moon and stars have gone black, and after a downpour, the thick clouds come back. The day when the housekeepers tremble by fears, and men of great vigor are bent by the years. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, that was verses 2 and 3. There's more of verse 3 coming later. That was from Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Ecclesiastes being one of the books of Solomon that it was believed, is believed and was believed to have been written by Solomon. And that was the Word Green translation from 2004. Our daily scripture for today, little children. Coming back now to our Ark of Urartu article. And something I wanted to say first, something I said yesterday was not quite correct, but it was close enough, perhaps. But when you're talking about, as an engineer, talking about strength of materials, if you've got a certain material, right, it's got a cross-sectional area, even if it's, let's say it's a flat board, looking at the end of it, it's got a fairly narrow cross-sectional area, but it could be wide and narrow in height. But if you made it, you know, half the width, then it's half as strong in terms of being able to withstand a downward force. So doubling the width makes it twice as strong. In other words, it's linear. 1.5 times as wide means 1.5 times as strong in the bending resistance or rigidity, whatever you want to call it, or but because it's not quite the same as tensile strength. Although that would be also twice as strong if you made it twice as big, because that goes as the area, cross-sectional area, which is the height times the width, which is the area. You double that area, you double the tensile strength, which is just the stretching if you're pulling it from both ends. That's pounds per square inch, so every square inch of area that you increase it by, if you double it, you double the tensile strength of the, like as if it were a thread being pulled, that sort of strength, tensile. So that's also linear. It goes with the area, though, right? It goes with the area, whereas here we were talking about linear with width. It's linear with the width dimension if you don't change the height, which is similar to saying it's linear with the area. But now the height is the thing that it goes with the cube. If you double the height, it's 2 times 2 times 2, or 8 times stronger. It's 2 cubed. In other words, it goes as the cube of the thickness for the bending. And I can't quite explain the mathematics behind that just yet as to why that goes as the cube, but it took me a long time to learn that. And that's useful to know because it tells you that, you know, even if you keep the width the same across it, that width is the same, but you double the thickness of it by adding another thick, well, you make, I'm not talking about a laminated piece, just one piece twice as thick. It's not just twice as hard to bend it and break it by bending. It's 8 times as hard. Goes as the cube of the thickness. That is the thing that was cubed. The thickness, not the width, but the thickness. So that's a very useful thing to know when you're building something. And the tensile strength, or the length of it, of course. If something is very... Now, the length is a much trickier thing, because if the length of it is long, sometimes the force can be distributed in bending along the length of it. And that can prevent breaking where it's connected somewhere else, because the force can be distributed in the flexing. So sometimes, you know, whereas if it were very stiff, it transfers all the force. If it's thicker, it transfers all the force to the point of joining, and that point of joining might break. Whereas, of course, I suppose it's going to transfer the force regardless, whether it bends or not, it has to transfer the force. But stiffness, flexibility and stiffness is not exactly as you would think, because sometimes when a structure has many members, the flexing of the members can share the force, right, among the different members, and it's not going to all the force won't fall on one particular join, which could fail. So in structures, it's and with length, it's much more complex. But so just because it's longer or shorter, we know when something is longer, it breaks more easily, right? We just know that. That's obvious. That's all, but we don't know exactly what all the relationships are when you get into a more complex structure. That takes a little more effort to determine that. But when something, okay, so we just had a piece that was wide with a certain thickness and width, but then the length of it, the longer it is, the easier it is for it to be broken, because there's more torque. You know, if the force is applied to one end and the other end is fixed, it's going to bend a lot more under that force. We won't go into those details right now, because for one thing, I haven't looked at it recently. And I don't even know if I can explain that part, but that is something that we know. You don't like things to be super long and also very thin, right? You want them to be thick enough so that it's strong. It's because the longer it is, the more it tends to bend and then also break. So length has to be included in this overall decision of how thick to make it, right? That's true also. And that's why when you look at the design of floors in houses, you know, they give you the how big a span a 2x10 joist can cover, you know, and without being supported except at the two ends and so on. And a 2x6 has a shorter span that can span across without any support in the middle, because these things sag and they, you know, they bend when they're not so. And in the case of a joist, it's on edge, so it's the width of it that is doing the bending. You know, it's like that. A joist is like this, where it's, because it's on edge, it's much more resistant to bending because it has that thickness of height, you see. And doubling that height again will give an eightfold increase, if you double it, that is, to the rigidity or strength of that member. Okay, so I mean, so that cubic relationship is a very useful one to know, but, you know, ultimately you're going to have to, if you're building something, you have to follow the code that's given in the builder's code and so on, of course. If it's that kind of a structure where it comes under a code, you're not going to just do it all by your own calculation. But when you're building something on your own, it's useful to know this relationship of the thickness cubed being related to the strength. The late Moses Kornatsi, he lived, we're in chapter 2, paragraph 9 of the Ark of Urartu. He lived in about the 410 to 490 CE range of the Common Era, that is, 410 to 490 of the Common Era. And in his book, History of the Armenians, he gives us the lineages for Haik, Nimrod, and the biblical Peleg table 2 below here. So this is fascinating and important, but he disagrees in his account of Nimrod, saying that Nimrod is the son of Mizraim, or Mestrium, as he calls him, Mizraim. Mizraim in the Bible, in Genesis 10:13, was the father of Ludim and Anamim and Lehabim and Naphtuhim and Pathrusim and Kasluhim and Kaphtorim. And those were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 sons of Mizraim. But according to verse 8, Cush was the father of Nimrod, which disagrees, so we have to be careful here, with what Mr. Kornatsi said, where he said that Nimrod is the son of Mestrium, and therefore the grandson of Cush, which could be true, but it, because it's consistent with Nimrod being the son of Cush, he's just the grandson. But it's interesting because it disagrees with what the Bible says. That it doesn't directly say in the Bible that Mizraim was the father of Nimrod. It doesn't say that. So that's something to be aware of. But this is an important lineage here because we have the lineage of Phinehas Pharsa, who was descended from Japheth, one of Noah's sons. Shem, Ham, and Japheth were the sons of Noah, as the Bible tells us, the three sons of Noah who went and survived the deluge on the ark. And this is the ark article that we're reading, the Ark of Urartu, or Noah's Ark. And now Sui Ren in the Chinese corresponds to the son of Shem, with that son being Arpakshad or Arpaxat, according to Mr. Kornatsi. And Noah's son Shem corresponds to Yu Chao in the Chinese. This character, Nimrod, was a great, mighty one, as if we look at this, Nimrod made the start in verse 8 of becoming a mighty one in the earth. He was the first mighty one in the earth, so that's why it's so apparently obvious that there's a good correspondence between the Chinese Qi Yu, who we see depicted here. Maybe we can get a smaller image. There it is. Who looks like somebody who you might call a mighty one with all the weapons he's carrying here in his both hands and his feet, and even on his head, it looks like he has weapons. He's got weapons all over him. So he appears to be what you would call a mighty one. So that would fit the biblical Nimrod. That's where we get that from. That's why we think it fits, plus the timeline. It fits so well. And so this Qi Yu is corresponding to Nimrod, but he's not in the same lineage as, of course, his opponent against whom he battled, who was Shenong. But they're contemporaries, as the table shows. They lived at the same time. And Shenong corresponds in time and generation with Shelah, or Saleh, as he's called by Mr. Kornatsi. Moses Kornatsi, who wrote the history of the Armenians, is where this table comes from. And Kainan corresponds to Fuxi, as we talked about before, or Kangji, as he's also called, who invented the Chinese language. So we've got Arpaxad, Kainan, Shelah, and then Eber is the Yellow Emperor, or Heber, as he's also called. These are all descendants of Noah's son Sem, or Shem. And the dates that we get for the lives of these patriarchs of the Bible, Noah's son Shem in particular and his sons, those dates come from the Greek Septuagint, where we are given how old each man was at the birth of his son or at the begetting of his son, and also how old or how long each one of them lived. So we have their lifespans given here for the sons of Shem. Now, the sons of Japheth, also it's important to note, among the sons of Shem, that Peleg was the son of Eber, and he is one of the sons of Eber, and he evidently did not go to China, and that's why we have Abraham descended from Peleg, and Abraham was not in China, he was in Ur, he stayed in Mesopotamia until he moved to Canaan, so he was of a son or descendant of Peleg, and that's why he could be staying or born in Shinar, that land where Nimrod was also located originally. And the descendants of Cush, we also see Arbel. Arbel would be a good match with Belus in terms of the name Bel. Belus was Sargon the First, Sargon the Great, as he's called, the founder of the Akkadian Empire, and one of his descendants, his grandson, was Naram-Sin. That would correspond to what a person that is also called Ninus in some of the accounts about Abraham. However, yeah, so he's called Ninus. He's also called Naram-Sin. But then there's also Ninus, who is this person, Ninuus, corresponds to Gudea, or Chedorlaomer, as we identify later in this article, that one. And Chedorlaomer is mentioned in the Bible as having been somebody associated with, we'd have to look at Genesis 14, and we would find that out quite quickly in Genesis 14. Chedorlaomer. Chedorlaomer was, he was living at the time of Amraphel, king of Shinar. And Amraphel, we identify with somebody called, in the book of Jasher, he's called Nimrod, but we just think that's sort of an anachronism that he's called that, but it's not the same person as Nimrod, because Abraham lived, you know, hundreds of years after Nimrod, about 500 years or even more after Nimrod. But Amraphel is basically the same. He's the king of Shinar, so he is essentially Nimrod in that sense of being king of Shinar. And we identify him with one of the kings of that Akkadian dynasty, who was very possibly Sharkali-Shari. Actually, he could have been the one of those later kings. In fact, the last king of the Akkadian Empire prior to Chedorlaomer, or Gudea, becoming, as he was also called, Ninus. He was called the Ninus, who was the founder of the Assyrian Empire, Chedorlaomer, as we've identified him in our article, the one we're reading now. We'll see that later in this article. But then when we look at the lineage of Japheth, and we see Magog and Boaz and Pharsa, and there's another lineage there, Gamer and Tirus and Torgum. And Hake was in that lineage. So that's Gomer also, by the way. Gomer, Tirus, Torgum, and Hake. Hake is in the lineage of Japheth also, but he was in Armenia. Whereas Phineas Pharsa, he's a very famous character in the Irish, I believe, history. Or the Gaelic history. I'm trying to think what we would describe that as being. But let's read here and see. But the Phineas Pharsa that is mentioned here was a founder of language, of one of the languages, one of the alphabets, or one of the, he was an important person, Phineas Pharsa. So he lived at the time of the Tower of Babel, which fits with the time of Nimrod here, and the genealogy of the descent lines here all correspond. That the Tower of Babel corresponded to this time of Shelah and Nimrod, or Shinnong and Nimrod, and at the same time as Phineas Pharsa, and pretty well within range quite easily of the generation of Hake as well. And then it was later in time when this second person called Arbel here in the ninth generation was living around 2300, which is about the beginning of, as we date Sargon, the Akkadian king, the Akkadian Empire. 2300 was approximately the beginning of that empire. And from Wikipedia, we see that here, 2334, they date the beginning of Sargon. That's one of the earlier dates for Sargon. We date it about 2300 or 2299. In one case, we gave as the date of year one for Sargon. So we differ a little bit by being lower. And the end of Sharkali-Shari we put at closer to 2140-something, I think. close to the 2141, which was the founding of the Assyrian Empire, by Gudea, or Ninus, who would correspond to Ninuus, 2141 being the beginning of that empire. So it's not far away from these dates, but there are many differing dates in the chronologies of time periods which are that ancient. So Ninuus is here mentioned. He would correspond to Ninus, perhaps, or Chedorlaomer. Now Shelah, or Saleh and Nimrod, appear to be contemporaries from this, both being born in the fourth generation after Noah. It agrees with Shinnong and Chiyu being opposing powers, because they're of the same generation. Shinnong being the corresponding name to Shelah, but in the Chinese mythology. In the Chinese mythology, when Shinnong sought the help of the Yellow Emperor, the latter won a victory over Chiyu. The Book of Jubilees says Heber marries Nimrod's daughter Azurad, and by her begets his son Peleg. That's Jubilees chapter 8, verses 7 and 8. In the Book of Jubilees, Nimrod is called Nebrod, and he is called Chiyu in Chinese mythology from the Jiuli tribe. Jiuli, nine black, corresponds to Mizraim with his eight sons in the Bible, depending upon the inclusion of Nimrod. So if we include Nimrod, there are seven sons of Mizraim without Nimrod, but we get eight if we include Nimrod. There's Kaphtorim, Ludim, Lehabim, Naphtuhim, Pathrusim, Kesluhim, and Anamim. Wait a minute, where's the Anamim? Let's go back to Genesis chapter 10. I don't remember seeing Anamim. Chapter 10. Oh yeah, Ludim, Anamim, Lehabim, Naphtuhim, Pathrusim, Kesluhim, and Kaphtorim. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. But with Nimrod, it's 8. So when we include Mizraim, there's 9. So that's where we get the nine black tribe mentioned by the Chinese mythology. Maybe that's where that comes from. So that corresponds well. Haik evidently was also a contemporary of Nimrod, living in the fifth generation after Noah in the line of Japheth, as we showed, and being the one who is said to have killed Nimrod with a long bow from a great distance, so by an quote-unquote impossible shot. That's a wonderful story of how Haik killed Nimrod by a long shot with a long bow. And that's the end of our study of chapter 2, paragraph 9 of the Ark of Urartu for today. Now, may we resume our study, our watching of the movie, The Ra Expeditions.
Lamps of oil. It was an unexpected and shocking discovery, which we reported to the United Nations.
As long as the stern remains intact, Ra rides like a swan over the waves. Everyone is safe and dry on board for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Norman, the navigator, finds the latitude with his sextant, Heyerdahl with his homemade noseometer. The crew divides assignments for keeping the ship in order. The food in jars keeps safe and dry. They have nothing canned or frozen on board. Flying fish, enough to keep the crew well fed. The dining table is a chicken coop, so the poultry never have very far to go. Despite some early troubles, the voyage of Ra seems to be going well. But one day, the crew gets a shock. The stern of the boat is beginning to sink, and water is washing on board. At first, they make the best of it. They even use the afterdeck as a wash basin. As the stern continues to sink, the situation grows intolerable.
It became so bad that we kept up all our papyrus life belts so as to provide Abdullah material with which to build the aft railing higher. But he soon needed more papyrus, and we were forced to cut up our two papyrus life rafts as well. Carlo tried to raise the sunken off section with a whole jungle of ropes, but everything was in vain. The stately but rigid wooden ships of the pharaohs would have broken up in the waves and sunk. Their idea with papyrus boats, however, was that the flexibility would allow them to bend with larger waves. While the forward and middle sections were securely held up by the mast by means of numerous stays, the aft section would flex up and down by itself, held up by a stay of its own running down from the curved stern, which acted as a large spring. But today, no one knew this, and since we lacked that rope, even though the stern retained its beautiful curve, the aft section sank slowly but surely. Too late, we had made an important discovery.
The situation is serious. Suryao can take his mind off it momentarily while he puts the children to bed. But then the crew must hold an urgent strategy meeting. It seems to them that if they don't do something quickly, they will sink. They decide upon a desperate course of action in spite of the danger involved. They will cut up their only remaining life raft, a foam rubber one, and use the pieces to bring up the sunken aft section. Abdullah says his prayers. The rest bed down wondering whether they will be afloat in the morning. Morning arrives. No further sinking.
Well, that's all for today. For that part of the Thor Heyerdahl Raw Expeditions movie. And so, in this case, of course, it's not simply the thickness of the boat that is bending, it's also, there's an issue with the water, that water is absorbed by the papyrus, and that makes it, you know, expand or weakens it or whatever it does. There are effects going on with the papyrus, which is a very fragile material at the best of times, you know, when it's very dry. They said before it was completely fragile, and it was highly combustible as well when it was totally dry. But when it's wet, it's very, you know, pliable or something. Who knows? But it's a material that is different when it's wet from when it's dry. And of course, when we're building something, generally we don't consider, unless we're in a ship, we don't have to consider the water. So, you know, we're not interested, I mean, in a lot of cases, with considering water and how it affects the structure, unless we're building something to be submerged. Now, they were building, they had built this boat, and so they're finding now that their aft end is sinking. I remember seeing this movie years and years and years ago, but I don't remember very much about it. But there's a part two to this movie also. So we'll see what happens. But, so that's the study for today. And it's so significant that we found a sequence that is corresponding to different nations. Phineas Varsa was a very, very interesting person. Maybe we can find more about him. I want to say more about him, but yeah, he's the Gaelic. That's right. He created the Gaelic alphabet, as we're going to see in, what chapter is that? Did we already see that? Barnes' commentary. Oh, we mentioned that already. Right. That's right. We mentioned that yesterday, so that's worth reviewing. So he's a well-known person in that part of the world where the Gaels lived and live. And so the nations at the time of the Tower of Babel spread out, of course, to the different parts of the world. So that's why we can have people creating different alphabets in different parts of the world around the same time. Fuxi, having lived just prior to, according to the generations here, just prior to Phineas Varsa, and he having created the Chinese language, the written language, or Kangji, as he's called, you know, who created that, whom we identify with Fuxi. So all of these things are fascinating. I've been watching that movie on The Legend of the Naga Pearls, it's called, from 2017. Quite a fascinating movie, a Chinese movie. I believe it's Chinese. I don't know the languages well enough to even know, but I believe it's Chinese. I might know Chinese well enough to know that it's Chinese and not some other language, but there are different dialects, of course, of Chinese. There's Mandarin, and there are other dialects. What's the other one? The Cantonese, yeah, right. For the movies, I'm assuming they use Mandarin, but yeah, because it's the main Chinese dialect. But I don't know the Chinese language very well. So that's it for today. It's September 23rd, 2024, of the Common Era. The time is 1740 hours, North American Eastern Daylight Time. Thank you for listening and watching. I'm Ward Green, and I love you very much. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie, saying bye for now. That was the Ark of Urartu, The Orient Express, Chapter 2, Paragraph 9. Our study for today, Little Children, and The Raw Expeditions, Episode 10, or Part 10.